The following is part two of the April 18, 2010 meeting of the Humanist Union of Madison on the Human Heart of Humanism with Jane Espenson.
Yes, and Sweden is certainly wrestling with racial issues right now because it has taken in so many refugees. Mm-hmm. It's taken, well, I live there. I moved there almost 3 years ago, and they had taken in over 44,000 immigrants and refugees from Iran, Iraq, Somalia, Afghanistan, Eritrea, which has caused problems in Sweden because of the religious backgrounds, and you bring in so many people and you put them in a little country and you have to put them in little areas in the beginning just to start out before they're moved to other parts of Sweden. And so naturally people who are know each other and can speak the same language and are similar are going to congregate, and then they don't want to move, and that makes perfect sense. But Sweden has never had so many immigrants come in at the same time. And before they had from Bosnia and from Germany and from Finland. But then you have the skin color the same and not so many people coming in all at once, and they could assimilate into the culture more easily. And the language is not so different from Swedish. But coming from those other cultures, it's creating a challenge.
Yeah. I've been to Sweden. I didn't live there for any length of time. One of the things I've been told, and that may be conspicuous, but not absent, but not necessarily conspicuous by its absence when you do your research, is that Sweden didn't go through the Industrial Revolution. Mm. At least it certainly didn't in the way that England and Germany did, the places that a newspaper reporter named Carl wrote about so often. And so that they may have had an advantage in going from an agrarian society into a modern society, and also not having an industrialist class. They had royalty, but they didn't have necessarily robber barons. So.
Yeah. Well, it's going to be interesting to find out because, you know, I don't know. But I believe that if we start with something that we can translate and take from what they've learned and the challenges they've had and bring it here, I can't believe that we're not going to benefit at some level from it. It might not be, you know, complete. And starting with a tangible thing, Waukesha County is where we live. This was my church is located in Waukesha County, but it's right next to Milwaukee County, where our congregation also does a lot of, is part of the Interfaith Alliance that I'm a part of and everything like that. So those counties are certainly going to be linked, but it will be difficult because we are talking about culture and religious differences and all sorts of things and historic part of our culture. We don't have the same culture as Sweden. We don't have the same. We have different challenges that are today, and they're inbred in the culture, and it's part of the fabric of who we are. But human beings are human beings are human beings are human beings, and I feel like there is something that we can learn. And I'm not saying it will be difficult. I'm saying it's a goal. I am not putting an end point on that. If I said, I think we should help out and make sure that we do something to help people who are in need, then I feel like we're standing here and then we're taking, I think that we should do that too. Yeah, let's do that. And then we take a step in that direction. Then you can say, well, there we go. We're trying to do something. Whereas I'm saying a goal to eradication is a good goal. Why should we be living in a country where there's poverty to this level? In this country, in this day and age. And so I'm not saying that it's going to happen fast or easily or in my lifetime. I don't know. But it has to be a goal. We have to have some kind of a goal.
Let me give an example of a problem. I live up by Students Point, and Habitat for Humanity call themselves God's People in Action. And it's run by a minister. When they get through, they take a torch to every room to be sure that Christ has visited every room.
Wow.
And I don't think that they would accept me, and I can't accept them.
They didn't accept my daughter for quite a while, but then she was able to go to the next year if she decided.
I can't swallow that.
Well,
and I'm sure if I told them what I believe, they couldn't swallow me either.
Well, my daughter wasn't able to go because she had a Unitarian mother who was a minister. So she was not able to go to be part of Habitat for Humanity. And she said, what difference is it, like me wanting to be a nun? What difference does it make if I want to be climbing up on a roof and be
Who's
pounding nails
well,
and whatever?
It makes a hell of a lot of difference.
What difference does it make? So the first year she wasn't able to go. The next year she met with them again and she said, I believe I should be able to go? How can you tell me, do you think that if Christ were in this room, Christ would say, I'm afraid you're not going to be able to go? And they would say, no, probably Christ would let you go. So, but they said she could go, but she had to make sure that she understood that at the end of every day, they would be in this group, in this prayer circle, and they whatever, and that she could, she didn't have to join in, but they would want her to, you know, participate, but that she needed to be respectful of that. And she goes, I will absolutely be respectful. Why wouldn't I be respectful of that? But that you also need to be respectful, but it's disrespectful of you to assume that I wouldn't be respectful of that simply because I think differently.
Yeah.
And so she went, and at the end of that trip, she came back, and many of those kids, it was in high school, had never met somebody who had not gone to church, who was not Christian. Mm-hmm. And they could not believe that here was this good person, this good, thoughtful, kind, helpful, nice, decent human being who had never been to church. And so she said that what she came away with was that most people don't know that. They don't really, they don't have these kind of conversations. And they don't, they just assume, everybody just assumes everybody's going to church and everybody's doing the same thing. And it's not until you have those conversations that it broadens your world. And she goes, in those kids' worlds, her world was broadened by going to these poverty areas. And their world, she came back and told me, was broadened because they had never, they didn't know you could be a nice, decent person without going to church. And it helped to open that up. And after that, the humanity, the Habitat for Humanity project was then open to everybody in the community where it had been closed before.
Well, I think
so
open,
things
I
can happen.
Couldn't do it.
Yeah, right. And some people can. But I think if we can over, that's why I don't care about theological language one way or the other, because I really don't. I think it's so personal.
But
it's so
do.
Personal. But they do. But we can override that by just saying, I understand that you feel like that. But all I'm really asking is just, you know, hand me a nail and a hammer, yeah. And I'd like to be doing this as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that, you know, God, your God, I believe, would really want that. And, you know, just speak in those terms of kindness and openness. I talked to the high school students in my church, and they're saying, you know, you can believe anything to be Unitarian. I said, no, you can't. And they said, yes, you can. Anything goes. And I said, no, it doesn't. You have to be a kind, loving, thoughtful person. And you have to really listen. You have to care. And you have to be open to understanding. They said, well, I hate it when people pray for me. And I said, why? And they said, because they shouldn't be praying for me. And I said, they're not condemning you to hell. They're not praying that you're going to burn and writhe and suffer. They are worried about you because of the way they've been raised. They're worried that you are, that's exactly what's going to happen to you when you do die. So they care about you. So just say, I wrote a sermon called A Shoe Into Heaven, because I have so many people praying for me that I'm definitely. But so I've told the kids, I said, just thank them. Just say, thank you for caring about me. I don't think you have to worry because I don't believe like that, but thank you for caring about me like that. Why not just say that? It's not a negative thing. And then you can go and have hot chocolate together, and you can get to know each other. And that's what life is all about. It's about getting to know each other. And that's what it is to be a humanist. I think you just care.
I'm sorry to learn that it doesn't also necessarily involve the hot chocolate.
You need to get out more, you know?
I just wanted to tell you that I might move to Waukesha.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Because I wanted to ask whether you know of any other Unitarian churches that have as their basic reason to gather together to administer social justice in whatever way they decide to do it.
No.
Because I don't.
No, historically there used to be. That used to be, the Unitarian churches were known for that. They were actual, during the 60s, for example, every Unitarian church, or almost all of them, Unitarian Universalist churches, were sanctuaries for conscientious objectors. And people would know, you can go to a Unitarian or Universalist church and you will be taken in. So they were known for that. The one that Peter Morales was in, he's the president of UUA right now, was in his fort, no, I don't actually know where he is, but in Colorado, it was in Colorado. His congregation, definitely known as the church that was for social justice, social action, immigration mm-hmm. rights, and things like that. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I have a comment about that.
We have right now on our mantle the deed to the property that I have in Douglas, Arizona, that I'm giving to the church in one of the Unitarian churches in Tucson. And I just got it, and we have to sign it and get it off on the way. They are, I can't say that's the primary reason why they meet, but they are a major sponsor of No More Deaths.
Yes.
And the some of you already have heard me talk about this, but that take the water out into the areas where people are dying in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
And their congregation had to approve.
Okay.
I mean, the board approved it, but I think it had to go to the full congregation for congregational approval before they would accept the land, where they may put a some kind of a gathering place on.
Mm.
And I think the land is zoned in such a way that they can do that. These people are risking their lives to go out on the desert, and it's getting more and more dangerous, and there's multiple things going on with, you know, governmental action. I'm not going to go into the details because that's not the subject today, but there's all kinds of things happening with the combination of drug dealing going on and all of the politics involved in that. Workers trying to get over the politics involved in that. Some very nasty characters on all sides of the fence. So they're putting themselves out there. And Mary Summers, whom some of the people, most of the people here know, Mary Summers has been involved in that. So this is a major undertaking for this congregation.
Hmm.
This is ongoing. I mean, they're really committed to it.
Okay. Well, and historically for Unitarian Universalists, we were the front and center for things like that. I mean, there were more Unitarian Universalist ministers who marched on Selma, Alabama, than from any other denomination.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have a really strong history.
I just want to point out that everybody realizes this, of course. I think that eliminating poverty is a huge undertaking. Locally, our next door neighbors here is the Allied Drive area, mm-hmm. which is one of the worst places in the whole Madison region for murders, drug dealing, poverty, racism, mostly black people. And so if we were to just to say, well, we're going to eliminate poverty in our, quote, neighborhood,
mm-hmm.
This is you can imagine what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, whenever you deal with black-white racism,
mm-hmm.
or races, so-called races, I don't
mm-hmm.
like the term, but,
I don't know.
You have mm-hmm. It's huge
mm-hmm.
issue, of course. Jim here can tell you, chapter and verse of about this.
But, the culture of our country, absolutely.
And it involves the whole subject of how students fail in schools and failing schools. All this discussion, most of the ones that are publicized and on TV and programs and so on are black.
Yeah.
Inner city schools that are almost 100% black,
yeah.
and so on. And these kids are failing not because their teachers aren't good teachers, they're failing because the culture is failing.
Yeah.
They're being raised in a culture that's lousy culture. They're not getting good parenting.
Yeah.
They're growing up with inferiority complexes, most of them, and they don't think they're any good, and they're going to fail anyway, and all that kind of thing. So,
it's complicated.
I've noticed more activism when I was a member of Unitarian Church in Chicago. We marched for racial justice many years ago.
Mm-hmm.
We marched against the war in Vietnam. We got heads cracked and kept at it until years later people were joining us off the sidewalk.
But you had your head cracked.
Yeah. No, not personally. My friend did. My head cracking came differently. But and in Racine 8 years ago or whatever, we marched, we protested the war in Iraq before it started. Bush didn't listen to us, but we tried.
Neither did the media.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And some of the activism is in relation to, you know, the problem that needs to be addressed that way. And I don't know that we would have the consensus that there's any problem that would immediately get all of us out marching this week or whatever, because there's not that focus on anything right now. And besides, we're all getting older.
I could see something that could happen, help Allied Drive right now. And I think there are a number of families that are caring families who are have a lot of strength, have a lot of warmth in their families, who just need some help. And one of the helps that I think would be one of the greatest things in Allied Drive would be a grocery store, for goodness sakes. Where
grocery store,
let me address that, because I've been working away.
Yeah, you know more than I
do. Every Wednesday in the winter anyway. And when that grocery store closed, Mike Bodden organized a bus to take them up to Woodman's, and every person there agreed to go, and when he got the bus, nobody went. And really? I don't know, these things have been tried on LI Drive, and when you go down there in the food pantry, if you go down there, you know, when you go down there, you're going to see affluent white people giving food to poor black people.
That's right.
I mean, there's no question. If it was the other way around, I don't think you'd accept that.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of things passing around there besides food. Mm-hmm. I mean, the white people get the perception that these are all black people who can't make it on their own.
Yeah.
The black people bring their children, and we're nice to the children, and the children learn that if you go there, the nice white people will give you these gifts, and it's a culture. And that food pantry is not utilized. We have a hell of a lot of food, and we don't have any clients. And we put up stuff, Marcia's translated in Spanish, uh-huh. Put it up in these buildings, and it's a big mystery. Mm-hmm. Now, if everybody who was qualified came, we'd be swamped. We wouldn't be able to last a day.
Are all the people that are working in the pantry white people?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. All the churches who are sending stuff down there and all the people who bring stuff are white.
There's some interesting study that was done by social welfare people here in Madison. And this had to do not with food pantry, but the utilization of social services.
Yeah,
and they found out that the major key factor in getting people in was having somebody at the front desk that was of the same language, the same appearance, the same culture. And even if the social workers happened to not be, but having that connection right at the beginning, so it's not just the rich white people, you know.
I know in my experience in Peace Corps, the one thing you wanted to do in Peace Corps was to turn the thing over to the locals. That's what it's all about. Mm-hmm. But I mentioned that down there. I said, there's something wrong here. We shouldn't be doing this. I said, we should get some of these black people to do it. And they said, yeah. He said, well, I had a guy come in and he helped me stock shelves and he did pretty well. And I said, no. I mean, right to the top.
Absolutely.
And I don't think that anybody there would think that these black people could do it all the way up. There's got to be some white people there someplace to keep the thing together. Mm-hmm. I think that's the prevailing attitude, mm-hmm. and yet you see black professionals all over. But this church up here is, what, two blocks away?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not a person from that church comes there. I mean, as far as volunteering, the food drives, we send them mm-hmm. food, they don't send any. I don't know why. It's just a puzzle to me. Mm-hmm. And
there was
the reason I keep going is because it's so puzzling. And I'm so interested, I can't figure it out. Martin Luther King said, poor folks have poor ways.
I'd like to just tie in on this for just a minute. Both the humanists, and let's get back to this, to humanists, because that's what we're here for, but the humanists and the Unitarians have been in the UUSC Service mm-hmm. Committee, have been into Haiti. Both groups have gone into Haiti, and the first thing they did was to connect with locals. And to work through other agencies than to, you know, be the manna from God that comes in.
Yeah, but first you need the manna from God.
Well, yeah. You start with the manna.
You need ships, you need helicopters, you need soldiers with guns, you need all of that. And then eventually, and if these things are not so corrupt that you can't work with them.
No, but they didn't come in with the soldiers with guns.
Somebody did, though.
Not where they were. They came in and they went directly to, I mean, they're... It's not like Haiti has no organizations. Like Haiti, Haiti's full of Haitian groups that are helping. Yes, and there's tons of NGOs that are doing some good work, by the way. And as of the evangelicals are at the top of the list in terms of the good work they're doing. But that there are structures, and they're perfectly capable of creating their own structures, if they have the education, if they have the wherewithal to do so. But I was very proud of the humanist groups that and the Unitarians that came in and worked with some of the smaller Haitian organizations. Some of them were first in there and right into some of the worst hit places. And well, you know, it took the larger quote, man is from heaven, you know, there, 5 weeks to get through the airport.
There was an article that I read, was in the University of Chicago graduate, you know, alumni news thing, a condensation of a couple that lives in Oak Park, Illinois, black professionals, and they undertook to only buy from black-owned businesses for a year. And they were in the Chicago area, and their biggest problem was they could not find any black-owned food supplier. The first blood, you'd say, well, Moo and Oink are the store that all the black people buy their meat, and, well, that's white-owned. And it turns out that there just isn't any. The only thing that they could do was to do something like buying a gift certificate from some black-owned convenience store. Would they take this gift certificate then or whatever and go to a grocery store? They couldn't buy any fresh vegetables. They couldn't buy any vegetables at all. They were willing to go anywhere in the Chicago area, and they could not find any black-owned. They other things they did, you know, they were able to find black-owned businesses that they could buy, from. They stuck it out for a year, but Dave talks about people that were only stocking shelves. Well, nobody was working at another level. Yeah. Didn't even start the small. Of course, the grocery stores in the inner city are a big problem anyway.
I think what's really bad is when some of these churches bring their youth group down to help at the pantry. And I think that's wrong. I don't think those kids should see that situation. Mm-hmm. And I don't think the people who are going to get food should get it from kids who are just down there watching. Mm-hmm. I think that's wrong. But I'm in a minority there, too. So. Anyway, I've changed
it. I think that one of the things that you're talking about is that one of the major problems is not poverty, but education. And there is one church, and I can't remember the name of it in town, that is doing an after-school program for kids of poverty. And it's been quite successful. So that might be one attack area.
Yeah, well, my charge to the congregation is that we're going to learn. We need to educate ourselves. I'm not thinking that we're going to ride in, we're saying, well, no, we're going to be the ones, blah, blah. I'm not saying that. I'm saying that's our goal is to eradicate, and that doesn't mean we are the doers. That means that we are the learners. In what are the issues, what's really going on, what are the complexities of this, who else is working on this, who can we also work with, what are the, you know, how does it work, and then why does it fall off and it isn't working, what is that all about? We need to educate ourselves first. And I think there's it's like an octopus, there's so many different levels and things that we see and things that we don't see. that are going on mm-hmm. all the time. It's very complex.
Yes.
So I'm not saying that we are the rescuers and we're the ones riding in on our white horse. I'm saying that our goal is this
sure.
and however it comes about.
I understand.
Yeah.
Can I take just a whole different tack based on something you said at the beginning? As I understand, historically, UU nationally has had this balance, Buddhists and theists and all this stuff. Is it your understanding that the balance is that very few quote-unquote humans, willing to say I'm humanist versus theists in UU nationally, and how do you see, or this group, how do you see this change from seeing a balanced respect for different points of view, multiple truths, i.e. UU-ism in its essence, to Mr. Schuller, there's a theist conventional component to that article,
mm-hmm.
and I'm questioning. I don't understand the balance. There's a fight now between the theists and the humanists. Da,
right.
da, da. When in fact, 50 years ago, the humanists, more people would label them as humanists, and seemed to be kind of a gentle give
mm-hmm.
and take,
mm-hmm.
i.e. the essence of UUism.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's this, I feel,
yes.
last 10 years, is kind of the fight. I don't get it. Do any of you have any help with me in this? Why is this? Certain elements are adulated, and certain elements are downplayed. And
I can give my own perspective on it. Like when I started seminary 20 years ago, which is the first time I really became more aware of what I was entering into. And that was about the time when Unitarian Universalism started to shift and change. And these are two small denominations, Unitarianism and Universalism, in the 1960s came together because they were very, very small. And they didn't grow the way that they thought that they were going to grow. And so the UUA, looking at this and concerned about this, was saying, well, if we have more language that is more like the religious language that's out there, we're going to grow because we are a culture in America that is more churches on every corner and God and Jesus and Bible language. And so if we start to take on that language back again, because we are a Judeo-Christian heritage, certainly, but if we then get away from this core humanist group, which core of essence of who we are as a denomination, which is from like the 30s to the 60s, then, and use this, bring back this language and spirituality mm-hmm. and all this kind of stuff, we will draw in more people and we will grow as a denomination. So it had to do with growth. The other thing that happened was that the UUA, in order to grow, did something what they considered a great mistake, because their idea was, we're going to have these little fellowships. We're going to start all these
yep.
small little fellowships all over the United States. And what's going to naturally happen is that people will discover the fellowships, and the more people will come, and then they'll grow, and then they'll have a minister, and then they're going to grow because they'll have a minister, because then they'll be seen as a real church, and then we're going to grow, and it's all about growth. But what happened, to the dismay of the UUA who wanted to grow, was that these little fellowships were very happy being little fellowships. And they didn't know if they really wanted a minister or not. And most of them, like, I don't know, we don't want that. They loved being this little group of people who came in, and they did not want to change from going from lay-led to even a part-time minister, much less a full-time minister, and what that was going to mean for them and what they're going to lose, you know, what they're going to gain, what they're going to lose. And it's a wrestling point. And so lots of those fellowships stayed fellowships because that's what they liked. And that was not the goal of the UUA. So then what happened with the UUA is it stopped being quite as supportive to the small little fellowships because they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing, which was growing. And so if they're not doing the growth thing, well, then the UUA, it's not going to be overt about it, but it's going to not be quite as helpful to these little fellowships as it was initially going to be, because there is all these rebels. And who were most of the fellowship people? Were they Christian language people? No, most of them were humanists. So that also gave that negative feeling to the UUA, these radical, negative humanists that are just going to, you know. And it's not a negative thing. It's simply these are personality types, and these are desires and passions and things that work for people. And it's not negative, but it has been posited as being negative. And that has been what has been this fissure thing. So we need to bring it all back together. People need to know their history. You cannot go forward if you don't know your own history. You need to know your history. You need to educate people. Then you need to be kinder and gentler and say, but guess what? We're all in this together. And it's not about growth per se. The goal should not be growth. The goal should be a relevant place to be. That this is a relevant and meaningful place to be. And that's what the goal is. And then you will grow as a result of that because, my gosh, there's something really happening there. I really like it, how it feels when I go there. I like the people. I like the things they're doing. I like what they stand for. I like the energy that's there. And people want to come into that. People want that.
You're describing prairie to a certain extent, you know.
Oh,
Rose and I,
of course you know.
one of those little fellowships in Whitewater. We moved there in 1965, mm-hmm. a fellowship that started, I think, 63. And so we had a maximum of, about 20, 30 people.
I don't think it ever went to 30.
Well, not including kids. I had some kids. Mm-hmm. The fellowship is now dead completely. But, yeah, we were like mm-hmm. that. Well, there were never a number of us, enough of us there. It's a pretty small town.
Mm-hmm.
10,000 people, including about 7,000 students at the university. So summertime, when the students were there, it was maybe about 3,000 people. It was mm-hmm. a big enough population
right.
to support a,
right.
A church yeah. with a minister.
Yeah.
You know, a strange yeah. example, back on Allied Drive, I hear Unitarian ministers say this, this love is what it's all about. Without mm-hmm. love, it doesn't matter. Well, there's a guy there who just despises those black people. He doesn't want anything to do with them. He won't talk to them. He thinks they're lazy. But yet he does all the buying, and we couldn't get along without that guy.
Mm-hmm.
He enjoys doing that. He enjoys doing the work. He enjoys the organization and everything. Mm-hmm. And so there's no love involved there at all, but there's a lot of Holland. And it's a Holland we wanted. Mm-hmm. We didn't want the love.
Exactly.
So you don't have to have any love at all. You have to like yeah. it as long yeah. as you do a new job.
Deeds.
Dave, his name is.
Deeds, not creeds. Just do the work.
Yep, that's right.
Do the work. Right.
There's yeah. one thing I wanted to bring up with that it's been bothering me greatly as a humanist is the healthcare issue. And I think what's bothering me the most is the... And I don't believe these people really hate all the, that just the attitudes of people are so afraid that their money is going to be helping someone who doesn't have a job or doesn't have money. But it's the, I mean, I was listening to PBS has been running a whole series of kind of like town meetings and debates, and these people are coming up with these, I feel like it's like back in the 50s or 60s, they're just being... Mm-hmm. Making comments that are very racist and anti, I mean, these people are out there, they're welfare cheats, they should get a job, why should I work to support them?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
what rights do they have? And I'm like, mm-hmm. it feels as if, I mean, I'm really concerned if this is just some phase we're going through or is just really the ugly underbelly of this country, and the feeling I have as a humanist that almost everybody else I meet has some kind of a theistic connection. And what bothers me are, where are all these caring people that are in my life that I think I know, and then all of a sudden do that many people really still hate other people and really don't want to do anything to help someone? They don't want to share their money or their fortune. And it doesn't seem to be a minority. I mean, these people were standing up,
yes.
being televised, and publicly stating that they don't want to be helping these people. They don't want to be helping anybody yeah. who doesn't have insurance. It's their problem, but they didn't want to be helping them.
But and unfortunately, those are the voices that were being shown.
Yes.
And those are the voices that are being aired on the radio. Mm-hmm.
Well,
but there are good things also happening, but we don't hear that because that's not as interesting.
Well, but this,
you know,
I think the PBS
so
was
trying
to
show those
I think
things.
They were actually just covering these town meetings and all, which, again, the people that go to the town meetings might be the people who really got something they need to say, but there definitely is an extremely strong underlying...
But where are our voices? Where are our rational voices? Where are they?
You don't hear anybody selling health insurance on
we
the fact that you ought to be your brother's keeper. You don't hear them saying, after all, there are people that really need help. What they're saying is... Well, you can cover your kid until he's 27. There's no all these conditions.
What's in
but
for
nobody
you?
That I heard stand up and says, we have an obligation to these people.
Oh,
we
I think,
to,
oh, there
and we should help
people
them.
Say it. There
I haven't heard the politicians say that. They always point out all these technical details. And I think that's they're missing the thing. They should say that, you know. We're trying to help these people. And if you got to make a copay of $5, well, you know, you can do it. And you can, you know, to help somebody else.
I mean, is there a groundswell within most other religions to support what you're talking about, the health care and being a brother's keeper? And
I don't know.
I'm not hearing that come up. I'm hearing people politically that are certainly are stating those kind of things. There are people who are, but
I think the religious, liberal religious people, you know, us, UCC, ELCA, mm-hmm. you know, Methodist, Presbyterian, actually, we all feel the same way, but we're not on the wave, we're not on the airwaves, we're not on the radio, we're not on the TV, we're not writing the articles in the paper, unfortunately, but those strong voices are the ones. So we're always the reactors. We're always reacting to them instead of having them. But there's an interesting book, it's not like a great book, but it's interesting, and it's called The Future of Faith. I can't remember his name. But anyway, he was just saying that it's a minority of people in the United States who are religious conservative, but they are the voices that are very strong. They're out there, out there, out there, out there. But it's a minority.
90% of the radio talk shows are conservative.
Yeah.
90%.
Yeah. I never listened.
But it's a small percentage of the culture that actually feels that way. But there's the strongest amount of voices.
This.
Exactly.
And then
we believe that is
the media
the bulk.
Know what they're doing. I mean, it's repetition. And it's getting out into places where all they give is Fox News or the people out in the barn. All they hear is Christian radio. And
so I think we should be writing to the UUA in Boston or calling up Peter and just saying, you are the president of the UUA. Where is your voice? Where's your voice on the radio? Where are your articles? Where's your TV? And what can we do as congregations? Where can our voices be heard? What can we do? Because we need to be countering what's out there, because we're only, most of us are hearing the bulk of this other way, and then people think that's really what this is all about, and we are the reactors instead of the leaders in this other way.
And the other problem with that is this is an extreme right wing as opposed to a centrist. And when the right wing speaks, you get the centrist. You don't get the extreme left wing, and then you compromise in the center. You have the center and the extreme right wing, and you compromise a little bit more to the right, a little bit more to the right. Because nobody puts out the extreme left. That's not even talked about. It's the centrist. The centrist becomes the left then. Obama becomes the left, and he's not. And that's no criticism. I think he's doing fine. But he's not the left. The left is way over here, Skuczynski and Chomsky and Howard Zinn and these guys. But you don't hear anything about them. You're always being pushed a little bit to the right, which makes it look like you're compromising. We're not compromising, you've given in.
It's all right to vilify the left, but you cannot vilify the right because they're Christian, and you can't say bad things about Christian.
I think that those restraints have come off. Not generally throughout the nation, but they've come off.
You don't love God and you don't love your country.
They've
it's
come off.
You're starting a war against Christmas?
Yeah.
But some of the talk show hosts are Rachel Maddow, I think, more than anybody else, has come out.
I think that if you attack a Christian, you make a martyr out of him. If you attack a left guy, hey, he had it coming.
Your point is well taken.
According to the New York Times, 18% of people surveyed are Tea Partiers, and they tend to be at the right wing of the Republican Party. They are not from the working class. They tend to be very comfortably well off. Yeah. And the main thing that they object to with the health care and all is they feel they don't want their money going to help somebody else.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're comfortable where they are. Mm-hmm. They don't need all of that reform.
Mm-hmm. Right, it's not going to affect them.
Yeah, I think maybe one thing we could do is all these people who are comfortable and think that they've earned it all by the sweat of their brow and so forth, we need to point out to them how much of their wealth and stuff is due to the commons that everybody else has paid for.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. They have no sense of obligation.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, would they make all their money if there wasn't an excellent road system? And all of the other amenities the government provides?
Part of the problem, Rose, I think, is that if anybody here wanted to convince everybody else in the room of something, he or she would get up, and what would that person do? Present facts, get challenged on assertions that need to be backed up.
Mm-hmm.
And there's an entire culture, heavily in the South and in the West, reasonably affluent, white, and evangelical Christian, where, and I mean this literally, facts don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Facts do not matter. Consistency with an ideology very nicely prescribed, internally very consistent, and if there's a fact that doesn't fit there, George Orwell wrote about doublethink,
mm-hmm.
and I remember reading it as a kid thinking, well, that's an extreme thought that anyone can have that.
Mm-hmm.
I see it around me all the time. Mm-hmm. And these people also are part of a culture. I don't need to go to a building once a week and pay money for its upkeep to be preached at and then go to meetings talking about scripture a couple of times a week to believe in gravity.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of stuff that people who deal in facts are comfortable with, and we don't need to go test them all the time or be reinforced. And these people are in a culture. And it's like, I grew up in New York City, and there were Yankee fans and there were Dodger fans. You didn't intermingle, you know. And it's the same thing. They've got their team, and that's it, and facts don't matter. That's scary.
Related to that, I saw a couple of news programs this morning before I came here, and they had both right-wing and left-wing speakers on. And the left-wing one was talking facts, and the right-wing one would say, the people don't want this health care plan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a lie, because it doesn't match the statistics. But they say that phrase over and over
yep.
again. The people don't want this, the people don't want that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was infuriating.
Yeah, well,
and
it's versus locals.
Yeah.
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 The Francis Schaeffer came out years ago with a...
I don't care what you say.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Obama gave a speech the other day and was talking in a factual manner, and afterwards they talked to people on the street. I don't believe him.
Yeah.
I don't care what he says. I don't believe him.
Yeah.
What can you do with that?
This is
exactly.
This goes back to
exactly.
to well, it goes back a long ways, but part a piece of it is the writings of Francis Schaeffer that came out years ago, whose son, by the way, has rejected you may have heard him on television, Frank Schaeffer, has rejected his father's pronouncements. But the whole notion of reality-based thinking, and that's a term that is being used today. It's you can follow the history of it, and that's bad news. Reality-based thinking,
it's pejorative. It's bad.
It's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're told it's bad, and they're preached that it's bad. You know, you believe it. You believe in your God. You believe in your Jesus. Believe in your version of the Bible. And whatever is in Scripture is right. And reality-based thinking is not only anti-Christian, it's evil. I mean, and this is... and it's hard to counteract that with people who are just such true believers. And facts don't matter. And you're right. You hit it on the nose.
One of the things that, cautionary, I guess, talking about, I'm still a paragraph or two back in working to solve some of the problem. I spent most of my professional life, education in the inner city, and addressing these problems. You know what my profession has found out from that? We don't hear, well, we thank you for having attempted to solve this problem and worked your whole life to do it. What we hear is, teachers are failures. Those schools are failures. You didn't solve all the problems. Screw you. Anyway, I would like to also, I sense maybe we're getting to the end, I would like to share one of my thanks. I am thankful for being plugged in and for the first time being able to hear. And instead of the singing the doxology, I know who to thank. Thank you, Bob Park.
Our topic today has been the human heart of humanism, and let's thank Jane.
Thank you.